Okay, tape's on, mics are live. Good afternoon. The Senate Judiciary Committee will come to order. Today is February 19, 2015. And we've got some exciting proposals to consider today, so welcome to everyone who is here for our hearing. A couple of housekeeping matters first. For those of you who are not aware, the budget division of this committee now has jurisdiction over six of the Department of Public Safety budget lines that were previously in the Transportation and Public Safety Committee. Those lines include the Office of Justice Programs. And so in order to handle the additional responsibilities, I'm appointing a subcommittee to take testimony in connection with the OJP budget. And Senator Champion is going to chair that subcommittee, and Senators Dietzick and Hall are going to be the three members total then of that committee, and they'll report back with recommendations to the full committee. So that will be handled that way. Secondly, we've got a couple of interesting bills on the agenda today. What we're going to do is take about 30 minutes, I think, at the most, for the Senator Champion's proposal regarding restoration of the right to vote. And so we should finish that around 12:30 or so. And then we're going to spend about 2 hours on the body camera bill. It is not the intention of the author on that one, that's me, to ask the committee for a vote today. We want to have the benefit of all of the testimony, the public input. This is a big and important issue. And we're going to want time to listen and also to digest the input. And so I'll ask the bill to be laid over at the end of committee today, and then we will come back another day to consider changes to it and final action on that bill, just so everyone's aware that that's the plan for today. With that said, I think we'll go ahead and jump right in to Senate File 355, Senator Champion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to the committee for taking the time today to consider a bill that I believe to be very important. And so I want to, first of all, acknowledge that this bill that's before you today is something I refer to as voting restoration. Voting restoration, and I believe that's important to frame it that particular way. And I'm also very proud to start off by saying that this Senate file is a bill that I am the chief author of, along with Brandon Peterson and Chris Eaton and Senator Thompson and Chamberlain. But I'm also proud that Senator Hall, who's also on this committee and a person I sit next to and talk to all the time, is also the chief author of a clone bill that is like this as well. And so I want to acknowledge that as well and thank him for his work on this important issue. So let's talk about voting restoration. And before I get started, I do have next to me, and you will hear from, our wonderful Hennepin County attorney, Mike Freeman, as well as some others. But before he talks about this important legislation from his perspective, I want to talk about it and frame it. So under current law, Minnesota Statute 609.165.
Senator Champion, would you pull the mic a little closer to you? Thank you, sir.
Thank you, sir. So under the current statute, Minnesota Statute 609.165 says that a person who's been convicted of a felony cannot vote while they are incarcerated, nor while they are in the community on probation or parole. That person would have to be discharged from probation or parole to vote. And this current legislation that's before you, Senate File 355, would allow Minnesotans to vote upon completion of incarceration when they are living in the community, paying taxes, and contributing to society just like what is already done in 13 other states. And I think it's important for me to briefly tell you some of the other states who do this right now. So Hawaii, Illinois, Indiana, Massachusetts, Michigan, Montana, New Hampshire, North Dakota, Ohio, Oregon, Pennsylvania, Rhode Island, and Utah. So that's just some of the other states that allow it right now. So let's talk about Minnesota. So approximately 57,000 1,000 Minnesotans are unable to vote due to a felony conviction. Approximately 82% or 47,000 are living in the community. They come from all over the state. Some people think it's just an urban notion or urban challenge, but I want you to know that 36% of the felonies committed in 2012 were in the counties of Ramsey and Hennepin, and the remaining 64% were committed throughout the rest of the great state. So that is approximately 33,000 are white, 9,000 are African American, 3,000 are Hispanic, and 3,000 are Native American. So there's no sound public policy to maintain Minnesota's policy of prohibiting people living in the community from voting. There's no evidence that it improves public safety or provides any other benefit. On the contrary, there's evidence that allowing people in the community to vote improves public safety. Research links pro-social activities like voting to a decrease in crime. Individuals interviewed about losing their right to vote express a feeling of feeling like an outsider. We believe that this will create an opportunity for them to be engaged. There are other good reasons to change this policy. It allows, it also perpetuates racial disparities. Disenfranchisement of African Americans is 7.3% of African Americans of voting age can't vote compared to 1.1% of white voting age Minnesotans. And if you think about this, the research also shows that children that are who see their parents voting, and if they're raised in that sort of environment, they more than likely also vote. So this means that the negative effect of felony that's causing them a challenge from not voting, it negatively impacts public safety and racial disparities. So I hope that you will support this today, because I believe that it's important for us to support it today. And there's a number of organizations that also support it, like the Second Chance Coalition. You also hear from the Minnesota Catholic Conference and several Protestant groups, such as Isaiah and the Minnesota Council of Churches, the Jewish Community Action, and Muslims and others represented in the Joint Religious Legislative Coalition. And so from the public safety and legal perspective, supporters include not only criminal defense and reentry focus group, but corrections professionals represented by the Minnesota Community Corrections Association and the Minnesota Corrections Association group. So the Minnesota County Attorneys Association, which you will hear from my good friend, Hennepin County Attorney.
Don't demote you,
I understand. And also supporters also include like the NAACP, and so I just think that the list is long and rich, but it just proves that this is something that others are engaged around, and we hope that you will also support it as well. So I would like to take the time to ask my good friend, Hennepin County Attorney Mike Freeman, to speak if the chair will so allow.
County Attorney Freeman, welcome back to the committee you served on when you were in the state Senate.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Senator Champion, thank you. I spent more than my share of nights in this room.
We won't be here tonight, County.
I think the legislature is a bit more civilized than when I was here, because I recall only too clearly about 3 o'clock in the morning discussing the rights of dead people and their privacy at 3 a.m., which was kind of appropriate. But today, I'm pleased to be here with Senator Champion and Senator Hall. Thank you for your leadership as well. To restore voting rights for folks who have done their time and are now on probation. And the present system in Minnesota, if you have committed a felony, you are incarcerated, you can't vote. That makes sense. But when you get out, you still cannot, as long as you're on probation or parole. And why that doesn't make sense is a person completes their time of incarceration, they're back in the community, beginning to establish their rights, and there is no more important right that people have than their right to vote. The Minnesota County Attorneys Association and my office support this because, frankly, we see it from two perspectives. We do, as prosecutors, we do fight crime and we do send people to prison, and rightfully so. But as they get out of their active incarceration, begin to return to the community, we believe their right to vote should be restored. for them, and frankly for county election officials as well. We help them over-supervise elections and to ensure their efficiency and integrity. And the problem in the present laws are a number of people who really technically cannot vote because they're still on probation and don't know it, so they try to vote anyway. And if they vote, we have to investigate them all. Under the present statute, we have to prove that they knew they couldn't vote at the time they voted. Not easy to do. So, for example, in 2008, we investigated some 600 individuals. We're only able to prosecute 40. We spent over $100,000 doing investigating, and even the people we found guilty received public service. So, Mr. Chairman, members, this bill will help to resolve that confusion. It'll enable us to save scarce public dollars for prosecuting people who commit serious crimes, and it makes sense. So that's why this broad a coalition, including the county attorneys, support it significantly, and we urge its adoption.
Thank you, Mr. Freeman. Any questions for Mr. Freeman at this time? Thank you, county attorney. I have next on the list Walter Hudson, a director of the Minnesota Republican Liberty Caucus. Mr. Hudson, present.
He's coming right now. And I'd like for you to see that he did sit to my right as well.
Noted for the record. Mr. Hudson, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for your attention. My name is Walter Hudson, and I serve as a recently elected city council member in Albertville, but I address you today in my capacity as vice chair of the Republican Liberty Caucus of Minnesota. That organization is an affiliate of the Republican Party that works to promote individual rights, limited government, and free markets. And we have joined a broad bipartisan coalition of groups in support of Senate File 355, which, as you know, would restore the right to vote to those living among us in the community. Whenever this kind of patchwork coalition that crosses party lines and ideological lines forms, there are diverse and divergent motivations that bring
Hudson, different. I'm sorry, could you pull the mic closer, please?
Sure.
Thank you.
There are diverse motivations that bring participants to that coalition. My reason for being here today and addressing you is twofold. First of all, I do believe that we properly ought to punish offenders when they violate the rights of their neighbors. A just society requires just punishment. I recognize that disenfranchisement stands as a proper aspect of incarceration. Prison inmates should not be able to vote, just as they are deprived of many other rights which would be theirs under other circumstances. That said, I believe that disenfranchisement is no longer appropriate once people are released back into the community. As an aspect of incarceration, disenfranchisement should remain behind prison walls. When we determine that someone convicted of a crime has served their time in prison and should properly begin to transition back into civil society, we place an undue roadblock in their path by denying them the right to vote. Participation in the political process conveys a sense of belonging and investment in the community, which those seeking reconciliation ought to have. And I'd like to expound upon that point just a bit, if I may. I think we could all agree that while there are certainly activities that are prohibited while somebody is under probation, and many of those activities are appropriate to prohibit, things such as consuming alcohol or engaging in offenses that would be considered relatively minor misdemeanor crimes by the rest of us, but when someone who's on parole commits them, they end up back in prison. Those are appropriate restrictions. The very nature of probation is that you're held to a higher standard than those who are not on probation. However, I think we can all agree that it would be somewhat outside the realm of reason to deny somebody access to an activity like going to church or pursuing an education or seeking and obtaining and keeping a job. And the reason why is because these are productive activities. These are things that we, under normal circumstances, would encourage people to participate in. And I believe that voting falls into that same category of activity. You know, it's somewhat like me banning peas and Brussels sprouts to my six-year-old as punishment. This is not something that would be appropriate in any other context. I want him to engage in good productive activity, good behavior. And while it's not a perfect analogy between parental discipline and the criminal justice system, I think the same principle applies. We want folks to engage in productive activity that vests them into our community. And so I urge you to support Senate File 355. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Mr. Hudson. Are there any questions for Mr. Hudson? Thanks for your testimony.
Thank you.
Appreciate that.
Thank you.
Brian Rehm. Welcome to the committee.
Yeah, thank you. Can you hear me?
Pull the mic
closer.
Forward. Thank you. Yes.
All right. I'm sorry. I'm quiet. I can only speak to today as an impacted individual. You know, I grew up in a good family. I was a pretty good kid, and I made some mistakes in my teenage years and got involved with drugs. And that spun out of control very quickly. And by the age of 19, I was in prison. When I got out for the first time, there were some very clear expectations of what I was supposed to do. I was supposed to get out. I was supposed to pay taxes, go to work, take care of my family. I found constant reminders of the mistakes that I had made, including difficulty finding a safe place to keep my children, good work, and I was unable to vote. I was hoping that culture was going to embrace me when I came out, so to speak, or at least accept me, that I was ready for a second chance. Instead, I found more acceptance from the subculture that I was supposed to be leaving behind. I was raised to believe that voting was a duty. It was something that you were supposed to do as an adult. And I watched my parents vote. My children never had the opportunity to see me vote and to learn those same values. That's all I really have.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Rehm. Any questions for Mr. Rehm? Thank you. Demetria Carter. Ms. Carter, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Demetria Carter, and I'm a member of Greater Friendship Missionary Baptist Church and also of Isaiah. Everyone has a story, but some stories are never told because a person feels that they are unacceptable in the community and shameful in God's eyes. Although this is very difficult for me, here is my story. I am a proud graduate of McAllister College and a mother of two young adult children who are also college graduates. They are the most smart, intelligent, and beautiful children in Minnesota. That's where you guys laugh. I have led a very normal life with all of its busyness. Kids' activities, figure skating, hockey mom, PTA, choir, Sunday school teacher, and the like. Then I was diagnosed with a severe mental illness that caused me to have an addiction. I made a mistake, and I am not proud of that mistake, but it caused me to serve time. Only three people in my church know this secret that I have kept. I kept that secret from my children for 5 years. I never shared it in my community because of the shame and the guilt. I am trying to rebuild my life and be active in my church and my community and be able to fill the void and the empty need that I have to be a part of that community. Restoring the right to vote for me and others like me is essential to restoring my human dignity. I want to be an active part of my community because my life does matter. I served my time, 79 days, in the adult detention center, the workhouse, and now I will be on parole for 10 years. I will be 60 years old this year, and I cannot vote because of the 79 days that I was inside. Even though I have already served that time and have been accountable for the mistake that I made, I will not be able to vote, which is a right that is so important to me and important, I believe, to others that are like me. I ask myself, where is the justice and the redemption in that? Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Carter, thank you for sharing your story with us. Are there any questions from members of the committee? Thank you very much. Susan Sheridan Tucker. Ms. Tucker.
Good afternoon. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity for allowing me to testify this afternoon. I am Susan Sheridan Tucker, Executive Director of League of Women Voters Minnesota. And you've already heard a lot of testimony around the facts and figures as to why we, too, are in support of Senate File 355. As an organization that is 96 years old and comes out of the women's suffrage movement, we do understand what it is like to be disenfranchised from voting. And so today I would offer our support from the League of Women Voters Minnesota that we do support this bill. We believe that this will make the 47,000 Minnesotans who are currently disenfranchised, that this will enable them to become whole in the community, and it'll enable all of our communities to be a whole lot stronger, for it will increase voter engagement and participation in our democratic process. So I ask you to support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Sheridan Tucker. Any questions from the committee? Thank you. Senator Champion, anything else you'd like to say? We do have an author's amendment.
Yes.
Before we take action on your bill.
I want to go through the bill, if I might. Oh, well, ask that we move the author's amendment first, and then I'll go through the bill.
Senator Champion moves the A2 amendment. Members, you have a copy in front of you. Author's amendment. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
I'm sorry, before we vote, Senator Limmer.
Mr. Chairman, could we have a description of the author's amendment of what it's doing? It's a delete everything. Before we vote, it might be something we should.
No, Senator Limmer, it's not a delete everything amendment.
I'm on a different A2 amendment. Senate file
355. 355, A2.
Line 2 deletes everything after the comma on that line.
Oh, just on that line.
Yeah,
okay.
Not the whole amendment.
All right. I'm sorry.
Did you still want a description of the author's amendment? Why don't we adopt it as an author's amendment, and Senator Champion can explain it as a part of the bill. Okay. Again, all in favor of the A2 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion prevails. The amendment's adopted. Senator Champion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will go through the author's amendment first. What it does, if you look on lines 1.7 through 1.10, this allows, first of all, for there to be an electronic data work available done by the Secretary of State's office for individuals 18 of age who are currently incarcerated in the state correctional facilities. So it deletes some other things there, because the whole idea is that once this bill if this law passes and the governor signs it, then the only individuals who would not be allowed to vote under the law would be those who are incarcerated, and we want to make sure that information gets to the Secretary of State's office or from the Secretary of State's office and to the public and to the appropriate places that it needs to go to. And that's also, if you look at that change, starting at line 1.21 and also line 1.22. And then also the same language is at 1.27. What is also important is that if you look on the back, starting at lines 2.13 through 2.18, I'll just say it all in one swoop. At one time, we asked for notice, and that notice be provided, but also an application to be available. Once a person is leaving, a prison or wherever, but we deleted that language to say an application because we just wanted people to be provided notice and didn't want to put the burden on probation officers or any correctional facilities to, you know, also have an application available. And then you'll see that there is a repealer there at 2.19, page 6, line 6. It deletes everything after 2014 and inserts section 201.155. And this came as this these changes came also at the recommendation of the Department of Corrections as well. And if you had any other particular questions, Commissioner Roy is available to answer any questions that you might have on the amendment. Seeing that there are none, I will go through. If you look at section one of the bills, just talk about the restoration of one's civil right to vote. It just talks about an individual who completes any incarceration that is imposed and executed once they are released, or if there's no incarceration, then they are able to vote. If you go to page 2, if you look at the beginning of things at 2.7 all the way through 2.17, it just talks about I certify that, number one, that they have to be 18 and so on and so forth. And, of course, the changed language is at 2.16 and 2.17 is just that they also say that they are not currently incarcerated. If you also look at Section 3, it just talks about, again, the duties of the Secretary of State's office in order to make sure that they complete information in a single publication about the voting rights of people who've been charged with or convicted of a crime. And then it also talks about publication and the distribution to judges, court personnel, probation officers, and the like. And they are, and also at 3.8 and 3.9, you see that the Secretary of State's office must make the publication available to the public on the Office of Secretary of State's website as well. If you look at Section 4, it talks about the Voters' Bill of Rights, but particularly 3.34 and 3.35 is that it also says you have the right to vote even if you have been convicted of a felony, if you are not currently incarcerated for the felony offense. And then also if you look at page 4, Section 5, it makes the same declaration and verification of registration. Section 6 just talks about, again, the notice of restoration of one's right to vote, and we saw that there's some changes that were made by the A2 amendment, but it just talks about the chief officer of each state and local correctional facility should designate an official within the facilities to provide notice. And we struck an application, obviously, in order to make sure that individuals know that their right to vote has been restored and that and of course, that they don't need to now because of the A2 amendment. They don't have to supply voter registration cards, but just notice and that we think that's important. And then, of course, it just continues with the new language around notice. And that is it.
Then, Senator Champion, the repealer is the mandate in current statute that law enforcement agency investigate any allegations regarding.
Yes.
I know it's been an issue that it normally a law enforcement agency has discretion whether or not to conduct an investigation. And current state law requires that the investigation be conducted even when they think there isn't any real crime that occurred, that it was completely inadvertent in this case. So we're getting rid of that mandate, correct?
Absolutely, Mr. Chair.
No.
Commissioner Roy, did you wish to be heard on this bill? No obligations, but since you're here, you're welcome to comment if you wish.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. Senator Champion has offered a proposal that is very near to our mission and our mission of public safety. We have long recognized that transitioning offenders back into the community is a good public safety strategy. Restoration of rights, restoration of other meaningful life activities, things that normalize a person back into good citizenship is always a good strategy. Department of Corrections currently has an active initiative called Transition from Prison to the Community. And one of the tenets of that philosophy is that people reengage in pro-social activities. And Senator Champion and others have mentioned the importance of that already. But we strongly support this. We also like the fact that it relieves us of a burden of identifying everybody on felony probation and parole in the state. That's pretty significant data burden, and the naming of people incarcerated in state facilities is public information already and very easy for us to do. This bill makes sense, and it's a good public safety initiative.
Thank you, Commissioner. Any questions? Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I know that you want to move along, so I'm going to try and be as brief as I can. But as long as Commissioner Roy is at the table, and perhaps I could have Mr. Freeman return to the table, I'd just like to ask sort of a general question. Gentlemen, a long time ago, I was a felony public defender up in the 6th Judicial District. As I said, that's a long time ago, and things have changed. And I want to ask you whether or not my understanding of certain issues revolving around probation are correct or not. And if I'm wrong, then I want you to help me, because this is really an important issue. I don't have any particular disagreement with folks who are sentenced to prison and serve the time that they are supposed to get out, are on probation, and want to have the right to vote. I don't have any particular problem with that. But I do have a good deal of difficulty understanding returning the right to vote to certain people who commit crimes who don't go to prison. Now, when I look at the sentencing guidelines, I see that there are folks who can commit second-degree aggravated robbery and not go to prison, burglary in the first degree, not go to prison, fleeing a police officer and causing great bodily harm, not go to prison, kidnapping, not go to prison. These are serious, serious crimes in my estimation. And if I'm reading the sentencing guidelines correctly, these folks under the sentencing guidelines presumptively don't go to prison. They get probation. And I believe that Commissioner Roy, just as recently as last week, told us that the state of Minnesota is 49th out of 50 states per capita providing people to go on probation rather than to prison. And we rely very heavily on our probation services to try and transition folks back into the community. As I recall, what happens during a criminal sentencing is that a judge would say something to the effect, you are hereby sentenced to X number of months in prison. That sentence is stayed, however, and you are placed on probation under the following terms and conditions. And then the judge is going to rattle off a bunch of terms and conditions, one of which got to be law-abiding. But for instance, perhaps the judge would sentence an individual to a work release program. We used to call it Huber. I don't know if we do or not anymore. Judge might order victims restitution. Judge might order the individual to pay a fine. Judge might order community service. In terms of the monetary, the restitution and the fine, oftentimes these folks don't have any money, so the judge gives that individual the period during which they are placed on probation to pay the fine. and the judge would say you are sentenced to, say, 100 hours of community service. But in none of those instances is incarceration necessarily going to occur. So, gentlemen, tell me, am I correct that there are serious crimes in the state of Minnesota which an individual can commit, never spend any time in jail, and upon release not have to comply with any of the terms of these conditions, like pay restitution to the victim or complete the community service, before the right to vote is restored? They simply are put on probation, and because they're not in jail, they get the right to vote. Am I correct or incorrect on that?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Newman, you obviously did your homework with the thoughtfulness of your question. Thank you. I can't speak for every place in the state of Minnesota, but let me talk about Hennepin County, where, unfortunately or tragically, about 50% of the felons are processed. If a person does not receive prison time, which in Minnesota, as you know, is a year and a day plus, if a sentence is less than a year and a day, then they are, in Hennepin County, sent to our workhouse. They're under our jurisdiction, the county's. They're incarcerated. While they're incarcerated, they cannot vote under Senator Champion's bill. And I would say on the cases that you've said, I can't say absolutely every one of them, but by far the vast majority of them would do workhouse time. And when they are in the workhouse, they cannot vote.
Commissioner Roy?
Mr. Chair, Senator Newman, these statistics might help you in that regard. And these are 2013 statistics from the Sentencing Guidelines Commission annual report on sentencing statistics. There were 15,318 felons sentenced in 2013. 93.4% received an incarceration sentence of some type. 30% went to prison, and as Mr. Freeman has just talked about, 63% did time in local facilities. The average stay in those local facilities was 106 days. The average prison sentence imposed in 2013 was 45.2 months, of which they would do two-thirds of that time. So we have about 10,000 offenders that do local time, and about 4,200 that go to prison. So it is a significant number that do local time. You are absolutely correct. If one views probation as a sanction, I can understand the difficulty you might have with this bill, but what one looks at probation and parole as a rebuilding of lives, I think this is an easy bill to support. And as an old probation officer from the 6th District, for a long, long time, the notion that probation is giving people an opportunity to get their lives together is really the philosophy that I support, and I think around the state people generally support. We do a lot in this society to discourage and to push people away from us. We put residency restrictions on them. We make it difficult for them to find employment, to find housing. I think the philosophy and giving them back the potential to become a good citizen with a vote, actually it's the message that is stronger than the actual results. It tells these folks, you are still part of us. You are our neighbors, you are our friends and family, and we're going to do the best we can to support you reentering our society.
And if I might add one
Senator
thing,
Champion.
Mr. Chair, as it pertains to probation, if a person is out on probation and there's this exhaustive list of conditions that the court puts forward, It is the responsibility of the person who's on probation to adhere to those conditions. In the event that they fail to adhere to those conditions, then they can be cited for probation violation and could, in fact, end up back in prison or in prison. So there are expectations, not only from the court, but even from a probation officer's perspective. But again, it creates an opportunity for the person to rebuild their lives and be a contributing member to society. And there are these conditions, and they have to adhere to those conditions. So again, this bill would provide that individual who is out an opportunity to engage in being productive. And again, the empirical studies demonstrate and show that when an individual is engaged positively in society, that they that the idea of recommitting or doing something that they're not supposed to diminishes. And so we want to promote that. And again, that message is very important.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Senator Champion. I do understand that when folks go out on probation, they have probation literally hanging over their head, and if they violate the terms and conditions of the probation, yes, then the sentence is going to be executed. And gentlemen, I do appreciate the information about the local incarceration. And from what I understand, what you're telling me is the majority of folks who go out and receive probation do some type of local time, and there is a small percentage that would commit a felony and don't do any time at all. But am I correct, Mr. Freeman, that under the way this bill is written, someone would have their voting rights restored before the, or could have their voting rights restored before the fine is paid, before the restitution is paid to the victim, mm-hmm. before community service is completed?
Attorney Freeman.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Newman, that's correct. What this bill does is establish, which you know from your time in the criminal justice system, a clear, bright line. That's something cops want, that's something prosecutors want, that's something public defenders want, and judges. If you're in, you can't vote, and when you're out, you can vote. It's that straightforward.
And if I could, one final
Senator
question.
Newman.
To that bright line, Mr. Freeman, insofar as Huber is concerned, in terms of voting, are you in or are you out? Are you incarcerated or you're not? Can you vote during or not? Can you vote during the day when you are out working and not vote when you return?
County Attorney Freeman, work
release. Mr. Chairman, Senator Newman, if you're in Huber, you're in the workhouse. You're released to work. You got to come back at night. Therefore, I believe under Senator Champion's bill, you are incarcerated and you cannot vote.
And there's no ambiguity in the bill.
Mr. Chairman, I learned long ago in this room not to try to interpret statutes, notwithstanding the fact I consider myself a lawyer. That's what we have distinguished Senate counsel to do. But as a country prosecutor, I would say that if you're on Huber, you can't vote.
Thank you, Mr. Freeman. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Legislative intent is on the record. Senator Hall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Champion. As many of you know, I've changed my mind on this bill. I was very much against this in years past, and for various reasons, which I'll go through initially here. And I think, even though I've changed my mind, I'm still tough on crime. So the question is before us, should voting rights be a part of this penalty? And my question, I didn't hear from a testimony, is has it always been this way, or what's the history of voting rights with felons? Do you have anybody like Ms. Walker maybe that could give some history to that?
You know what? I'm going to call I'm a phone a friend right now for that. And I'm going to call Mark Hasse or Sarah. Both can come up to the table. And these are two good friends because they've worked very hard on this bill and this proposal, and so I think it would be appropriate.
Well, thank you. Senator Terlatz and Senator Hall, thank you so much. And as Senator Hall pointed out, that I think that both the constitutional intent when we were at statehood indicates that the Constitution's intent was not to deny people the right to vote from if they were living in the community. And the reason we believe that is because the enabling language that's defined right now actually says you're allowed to define the sentence, what a sentence means. But at the time of the writing of this enabling language, there was no formalized system of probation or parole. That wasn't even created or contemplated until about 1910. And then there really wasn't an expansive system of probation until many years later. So if we look back at sort of the founders' intent, they could not have possibly meant people on probation or parole would be denied their rights. Furthermore, at the time of the founding, we only had 36 people in prison. We also had many fewer crimes that were considered felonies. And over the years, we've increased the number of crimes and also increased the use of probation.
You want to add anything?
No.
Well said. Whenever a woman says something that eloquent, you just go forward. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Senator Hall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So then the way I look at this, you know, it's what is good for society here. Do we keep them incarcerated longer? Do we give them voting rights, not voting rights? Is that part of their punishment for doing a crime? And then I looked at how this affects others. There is always a ripple effect when someone does something wrong or something good. And as I looked at that, I also wondered, then what's the effect of the family? Not just the person that was incarcerated, the felon, but what about his wife and his kids? And how does a kid of a felon stand proud? You know, my dad was a drunk, at least for 4 years of my life, between age of 8 and 12. And I didn't talk much about my dad. I didn't try. I tried not to even be around him. But then he sobered up and hasn't drank for whatever, 50 years. And from that point on, I was so proud of him that this is my dad. Now, he still had a lot of learning to do, as we all do. But he showed up to every one of my games. And that's my dad up there. And so what does that do to the family, to the kids of the family, when their dad is, well, you know what, he served his time, but he still can't vote. And I must be a second-class citizen, too, because my dad can't vote. I don't want our society to be like that. I want our society to be encouraging and building up. We don't want to penalize families. We don't want to penalize the kids. And you might say, well, they shouldn't have done that then. That's the effect. But we are the leaders of society, so we decide what should and how can we help the family, what should affect. So part of my vision has come from a friend of mine whose daughter was, at the age of 16, taken on her way home, pulled into the woods, and raped for 4 hours. She escaped. He was caught. And this friend of mine, who actually is a an owner of a Stanley Cup ring, afterwards, the day after, went to that jail and asked to talk to the man that did this to his daughter. And he told the man he forgave him. I don't have any idea how that can work, because I don't think I could do that. But the vision of that and the effect that that had on the healing of for him and his family, and I hope for that gentleman, I don't know whatever happened to that gentleman. I know he spent years in prison. And let me say this, that my heart goes out to the victims of those that have been victimized. But I think as a society, we want to look at how can we encourage society, not keep penalizing or holding over the head of people you're a bad kid. Whether it's the person that actually did it and is out of jail, he should have done his time. And if he didn't get enough penalty, then we should increase the penalty in jail. How many years he should be there. But not continue to hold it over his head. When my kids do something wrong, I don't think, you did something wrong. Remember that. You did something wrong. I forgive and I try to forget. Because I want to encourage my kids that they're good kids and they can do better. And the positive approach is always best. Be a good citizen, not to hold it against them. I believe our American values are in forgiveness and restoration. So I'm voting for this. Thank you.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Champion, maybe you can answer a question for me. I've heard that judges will impose a sentence, but they will stay the sentence. And would that be equivalent to a probation sentence, or is that something a little bit more?
Senator Champion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Limmer. So if the judge stays a sentence, it is possible that a judge can stay a prison term but still send them to the workhouse or send the person to the workhouse or something of that nature. If the person goes to the workhouse, then that is still considered incarceration, and therefore that person would not be allowed to vote while they are in the workhouse or during any incarcerated time.
So, Mr. Chairman, the operative word is incarceration, not sentenced or impose a sentence.
That's right.
To a correctional facility. The other question I did have as I look at this, I noticed the lineup on the testifiers here today, and what's noticeably missing are the voice of victims. Do we have any one here that would be a victim that's been brutally victimized by a felon who now it might be on probation? I don't see one on the list. It's unfortunate that we don't have victims here, but, schedules are busy. It's cold outside. Some people might even have one or two or three jobs that they have to be employed at in order to keep food on the table for their families. Oftentimes they might require two or three jobs as a result of being victimized due to some physical ailment that they might have that would prevent them from a full-time employment elsewhere. Or perhaps a potential employer might not want to hire someone if they have an infirmity that can't handle a physical burden. But as I listen to this bill, I've heard this kind of a bill before. I've often wondered, even in those days when we've heard this bill before, I'm wondering where the victims are. And what would the victims say when someone's daughter has been brutally victimized by someone, and at least up till now, presently, a suspension of one's civil rights is considered part of a sentence. And so as we go forward on this bill, if it continues forward, I'll be asking that question again because I think it's very important. We have 40,000, 50,000 people that has been framed in this argument, but I'm more concerned about the 5 million citizens in the rest of the state that might want to have a say in this.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Champion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Limmer. Senator Limmer, thank you so much for your comments, and I always think it's important to have everyone put their thoughts on the table, and that is a legitimate concern. We are always concerned about victims, and I believe that victims are considered, they're able to come to the court and also talk about how something has impacted them, and I believe that's important. And so for today's purposes, the proper notice has been given. We have widely distributed this hearing because we want to make sure that we hear from a variety of different people, and we have. And let me tell you something that I believe to be very important, is that when most people talk about this sort of bill, they usually go to the very extreme and talk about, you know, things like rape, or they talk about crim sex, or they talk about those things. And those things are important. But most people fail to think about that everyday person who may have tried to check kite. And check kiting is when they believe that their deposit is going to be put in the bank at the right time, and then they write a check in anticipation of that. And guess what? The direct deposit fails to get there, and the person wrote a check for over $500 in anticipation of that direct deposit being there, and they get charged with a felony crime. We're talking about that person as well. We're talking about that person who may have had a problem with chemical dependency, and they seem to keep getting behind the wheel of the car, and they get stopped over and over again, and the crime escalates, even though the behavior doesn't have to escalate, but the crime escalates in severity, and they get a felony on their record. Should that person not be allowed to vote? Should that person who attempted to, you know, write that check, should they not be allowed to vote? So I do believe that this is a comprehensive approach to consider every individual. And I think the victim would say, if we're talking about a victim, that they would say, I want that person's behavior to change, and I want them to be given an opportunity to change so no one else has to endure whatever I had to endure. And I believe that is what a victim would say, because they, too, would think a person deserves a check, a second chance. Because if they're given a second chance, or if they're given an opportunity, then that means no one else would have to be in the position that I was in. And we want to promote positivity, and we want to promote pro-social behavior. And I think this bill provides an opportunity for people to
Senator Champion, there are a number of victims' rights organizations that monitor activities here at the Capitol. Have you been contacted by any of them in connection with this bill?
Mr. Chair, yes, and they've said that they are in support of this bill.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, one quick question I had, and maybe Senator Champion, you might be able to answer this. On Attorney Freeman's support of the bill, was Attorney Freeman representing his own views, or was he representing a larger prosecutor organization?
County Attorney Freeman is here. Maybe he can answer the question himself. And I believe he said he was here on behalf of the County Attorneys Association,
right,
as well as the Hennepin County Attorney.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Limmer, I'm here for myself, for the Hennepin County Attorney's Office, and for the entire Minnesota County Attorneys Association. We unanimously agree that this bill makes sense.
Okay, thank you. Oh, and by the way, Attorney Freeman, I wanted to thank you and your office for pushing for that particular sentence issue out in the Maple Grove area. A lot of people were greatly they were following that carefully. And I'm sure on their behalf, I want to thank you and your office for pursuing that issue.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Limmer, thank you.
One other question,
Senator
Mr.
Limmer.
Chairman. I've always seen probation as kind of a definition of the very word that it represents, that it's a kind of a trial period. You're on probation, meaning you have to prove yourself. You have to prove yourself that you're ready after you've been convicted, after perhaps you spent some time in prison, but that this is a trial period. And if you flub up, you could go back to prison.
Mm-hmm.
If one is sentenced to a probationary time and there's a consideration to restore a right to vote or any other right, where does the trial time fit in to the formula now? Where does it fit into the timeline? If you immediately get your civil right to vote restored, you really don't have to prove yourself that you're ready to be a lawful citizen anymore. So aren't we putting the horse behind the cart now and changing the order of a probationary purpose?
So, Mr. Chair,
Senator
and
Champion.
Senator Limmer, thank you for the question. A person's right to vote is restored.
You know that we don't vote very often, and so I'm not sure what the timeline would be between when they are released and when they actually would exercise their right to vote. But we do believe that that the right to vote should be restored. That person then would still have to continue to demonstrate to their probation officer, if they're on a probationary sentence, that they are fulfilling the conditions of their probationary sentence. So so they are always demonstrating and proving that they should be out and intermingling or mingling with society. In the event that they don't, as I mentioned earlier, the probation officer can file a probation violation. That person then could appear back before the court. They would be entitled to a Morrissey hearing. And in the event that it is determined that they did not fulfill the conditions of their probation in any shape, form, or fashion, they could be sentenced to prison, workhouse, or whatever the judge would see fit. And let me also say, because I know you asked this question earlier, I want to make sure that folks are informed as to the other groups who support this bill. Public safety, we have the Conflict Resolution Center of Minnesota, the Legal Rights Center, Minnesota Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, Minnesota Community Corrections Association, Minnesota Corrections Association, Minnesota County Attorneys Association, State Public Defenders, faith-based organizations, Isaiah, Jewish Community Action, Joint Religious Legislative Coalition, MICA, which is the Metropolitan Interfaith Council on Affordable Housing, Minnesota Catholics Conference, Minnesota Council of Churches, Minnesota Unitarian, there it is, Universalist Social Justice Alliance, that's a mouthful, Direct Service Organizations, the African Immigrant Services, American Indian OIC, Goodwill Easter Seal, Life in Recovery, Mad Dads, Minnesota Adult and Teen Challenge, Minnesota County Community Action Partnerships, Minnesota Recovery Connection, the Neighborhood Hub, Northside Achievement Zone, Open Access Connection, St. Stephen's Human Services, Twin Cities Rise, Civic Engagement and Advocacy Organizations, Advocates for Human Rights, African American Leadership Forum, ACLU of Minnesota, Children's Defense Fund Minnesota, Citizens for Elections Integrity, Common Cause Minnesota, Council on Crime and Justice, Growth and Justice, Integrated Community Solutions, Land Stewardship Project.
Mr. Chair, I think we could read that.
Yeah.
I'm not sure he has to go through them all.
I just want you to know.
It's a broad coalition.
Coalition.
Yes. Mr. Chair.
All right. Senator Goodwin.
One quick thank you for bringing this bill.
If you had a follow-up question, Senator Dietzick did have her hand up earlier.
Oh, I'm sorry.
All right. Senator Dietzick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Do you have a question?
Yes. Well, it's just a comment. I was going to thank Senator Champion for bringing this bill and for all that worked on it. I will reiterate very, very briefly what Senator Hall said earlier. I agree with him. I think that we have a one of the values in our country is that we allow people a second chance and they get to prove themselves. And I think that they're still on probation, and so if they violate the probation, they could be sent back to prison. And so I think this is a good part of getting people involved in the community and active in their community and part of our civic community. I will point out that at one point in the past I was door knocking in the African American community, and what I was surprised at was the number of women, and these were young women who could not vote. And so it is not just men who couldn't vote, these were young women. And so finally I actually asked one of them, and they were caught up when they were 18 in drug instances, and usually it was their boyfriend who, and they got caught in, and so they got, because of sentencing guidelines, were, you know, convicted of a felony, and so they couldn't vote. And I remember, one of the things I remember growing up is I would go vote with my parents. We would, you know, they would drag us down to the voting poll, and so we would go vote. Well, these moms didn't have a chance to do that with their kids, and so their kids are not being taught to go vote. And so if we want people involved and engaged in our community, I think this bill goes a long way. So I'm supportive of it. Thank you.
Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And quickly, I just want to say thank you again for the bill. I had a man in my district that called me before the last election, and it was about a week before, and he said, you know, I've been on probation for 13 years after getting out of prison. I got a family. I got a home. I got you know, children. I got a job. And the only thing is they didn't ever put a time limit on my probation. So I can't vote, and I want to vote. And he could have quite likely been a Republican. I don't know who he was going to vote for. But at any rate, I called the county, and they said, yeah, there's no reason why we can't take him off. But they were telling him that they couldn't. So he was allowed to get off, and he was allowed to vote. And though that's probably not a real rare circumstance where they're still on probation and actually don't need to be anymore. He hadn't committed another crime. He hadn't skipped probation or anything. So this is a really good way, I believe, to get people back involved in the community and help them become active citizens again.
Senator Sharon, would you like to add anything?
I suppose. Mm-hmm. I sort of feel a little pressure to. I think that when a person is incarcerated after committing a crime, that we extract many things from them, their ability to interface freely with their family, their friends, their neighborhood, to have their live in their homes, to work a job that really advances them professionally. So we extract from them in the incarceration many of the rights that the rest of us experience when we don't commit crimes, including the right to vote. So on probation, even though it is still a portion of their sentence, they are restored many, many rights that were withheld from them while they were incarcerated, to be again with their families or to live in their community, to interface freely in the community. So why we would select this particular one to withhold at that time is hard for me to understand, particularly because allowing for reasonable conversations about the law, about policy, about government, seems to me to be a healing process. And in some ways, I wish they would engage in that before they left incarceration, because I think if we would encourage them to actively engage in that even earlier, it would be productive for them in terms of returning to society. So I'm very glad that you've initiated this process, Senator Champion, and I'll be supportive.
I'm just going to add real quickly some information right out of the Liberty, Minnesota material, which is part of our packet. And I will note parenthetically that they are housed in St. Louis Park in my Senate district. But they point out, and I'm not going to repeat what's already been said, but they do point out that when these folks are back in the community, hopefully they're working and they're paying income taxes. And if they're buying products, they're paying sales taxes, but they don't have the right to vote. And our country was founded on the principle, no taxation without representation. So I think we ought to restore their right to participate in selecting their elected representatives if they're paying those taxes. With that said, Senator Champion, closing words, please.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, for spending a little extra time. I know that we wanted to get through this bill in a half hour because I know that there's another important piece of legislation that's before us. But this is an important issue that I believe that we all recognize. I think it's time for us to move this conversation forward and restore the rights of others to vote, because we believe that voting is an important part of our democracy, and we should not impede a person's right to vote. We should encourage them to vote, and we want to make sure that as this wonderful society that we have, that we have a thriving workforce, and that we want them to individuals that have made a bad choice but now have gotten on the path of I would say righteousness, but a solid path. We want to encourage that, and we want to encourage them to be the very best that they can be, so that they can model that for their children, and for their children to walk in their footsteps towards equality and towards equity and towards productivity. So with that being said, I move passage of Senate File 355 and ask that it be referred to
the Rules Committee so the Subcommittee on Elections can consider it.
As amended.
That will be my motion.
Senator Champion moves that Senate File 355, as amended, be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Senate Rules Committee. Shall we vote?
Yes.
All in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The motion prevails. Thank you.
Thank you.
Anyone want to talk about body cameras?
I'll leave that to you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, so in case anyone arrived after the initial beginning of this committee, I will reiterate that as please, member, audience, as you're leaving, we are going to continue to conduct business, so please take your conversations into the hallway. As author of the body camera bill, I'm going to be requesting at the conclusion of the hearing that the bill be laid on the table so that we can evaluate and consider the input that we received during this committee hearing. With that said, I'm going to ask the vice chair of the committee, Senator Goodwin, to come forward to chair the committee during this portion of the hearing.
Senator Letts has Senate File 498, Peace Officers Portable Video Recording System, Data Classification, Use and Retention Regulation. And I do believe you have a delete all amendment. And that would be the A, let me see. Hold on. I've got to see if I have it. Is that the A3 amendment?
Yep.
To Senate File 498.
Thank you. Yes, Madam Chair, I do have an A3 amendment that puts the bill in the shape that I would like to have it considered. This is an author's amendment, and I move the A3 amendment.
Okay, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. Senator Letts.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As members of this committee know, and undoubtedly many others know, the technology relating to the availability of cameras that can be are small enough and can be carried around on the shoulder or on the neck of a law enforcement officer are now beginning to be available to our law enforcement communities. And these cameras have great potential for enhancing public safety and accountability within the community, accountabilities of all those who are involved in a criminal justice incident. Some law enforcement agencies have started to use body cameras and are having experiences with it. And their policies vary on a number of different aspects of how to utilize the cameras, and importantly, what to do with the data, the video and audio information that is recorded by these body cameras. So this issue is happening around the country and also, of course, in Minnesota, where there are a number of police departments that are currently using body cameras. So it was my belief that it was time for the legislature to take a serious look at this question, because we have in Minnesota a certain classification scheme for information that is gathered by the government. And what to do with the data that's gathered by body cameras, I think, is an important public policy question, and that's what is before you today. Prior to this hearing, knowing that the issue was going to be before us, I requested that the interested stakeholders, at least the ones that I was aware of at the time, feel free to send in their comments to my office as to how they thought this regulatory scheme ought to be set up. And we did receive input from a number of community organizations and stakeholders. And the delete all amendment that we just adopted incorporates many of those suggestions. And it works off of the framework that the data that is gathered is going to be classified as private information. And then it sets forth a number of criteria for circumstances under which that data can become public. It also sets forth proposed criteria for how long that data must be retained, how long that data can be retained, and what is to happen at the end of the use of or retention of that data, namely destruction of the data. It also sets forth criteria as to who has access to that data and under what circumstances. So, members, what you have before you is my best efforts at this time to strike a balance between what I have come to conclude are, frankly, some irreconcilable positions. There isn't going to be anyone at the end of the day here that is going to feel that whatever we do is entirely satisfactory, because I think there isn't any way to strike a complete balance that recognizes everyone's interest in privacy and everyone's interest in public accountability. Because every time you have something that's public for public accountability, you are making public something that was private before, or at least private in the sense of not on a video that can be posted on YouTube.
Pretty not private.
So this has been probably one of the most difficult policy issues I've struggled with, and what I have before you is a proposal that I welcome the input from the committee and from the stakeholders and those who have an interest in this bill before us today. And that's why, because this is an important public discussion, I wanted to not come to a final conclusion today, but to give all of us a chance to think about what is presented here and a chance to make modifications or changes before we make a final recommendation as a Judiciary Committee to the rest of the legislature. Members, the bill before us now classifies body camera data as private data on individuals or as non-public data, which is not data on individuals, but both of them would be not public. Private data refers to a person. Non-public data refers to data on an object. This means that only the subject of the data, the person in the video, has access to the data. Under this bill, law enforcement agencies would be required to maintain the following public data: the total number of devices owned or maintained by the agency, the daily record of the total number of devices deployed and used by officers, the agency's policies for use of body cameras, and the total amount of audio and video data collected, as well as the agency's retention schedule and procedures for destruction of the body camera video. Data that are not criminal investigative data, that have not been flagged by law enforcement, must be maintained for at least 90 days and destroyed within 1 year. If the data has been flagged, it must be retained for at least 1 year and destroyed within 3 years. Data will be flagged if the incident involves a use of force by a peace officer. And the bill defines use of force as use of a dangerous weapon or use of physical coercion that causes substantial bodily harm. Substantial bodily harm is well defined in other parts of Minnesota law as bodily injury which involves a temporary but substantial disfigurement or which causes a temporary but substantial loss or impairment of the function of any bodily member or organ, or which causes a fracture of any bodily member. Levels of harm, sort of the scheme of harm in our statutes, include bodily harm, substantial bodily harm, and great bodily harm. Bodily harm would be on the level of a black eye or a restraint that is painful but does not damage the body. Substantial bodily harm would include things like broken bones. Great bodily harm, which would also be included as flagged data, would include use of deadly force or hitting someone so hard they could be permanently incapacitated. And then, of course, death would be included. Also, data will be flagged if a formal complaint is made against an officer. Data will be flagged if an individual can articulate specific facts to support a reasonable belief that misconduct by a peace officer occurred during an incident. And the goal of this language is to prevent access to data for simple fishing expeditions where a person asks for volumes of data and combs through it looking for issues. If a data subject submits a written request for law enforcement to retain data, then law enforcement will retain the data for 90 days and notify the requester that if they want the data retained longer, they must make a new request. And by the way, the subject of the data, and this is a clarification which I think is important because I'm not sure that everyone understood this, the subject of the data includes the law enforcement officer that is involved in the incident, as well as any person that is seen on the recording. Also, police chiefs and sheriffs can retain the data on one of their officers for an additional period of time. A person who is in a body cam video, the data subject can request access to a video. In the event that there are multiple people in a video and the other individuals of the video do not consent to its release, the identities of those people must be redacted by law enforcement before release. And redacted means rendered so that the identity of the person is not knowable. Law enforcement agencies must have their data collection systems audited every 3 years to ensure compliance with the Minnesota Data Practices Act, Chapter 13. And by the way, the Data Practices Act is sort of the overarching framework for this, as well as all other government data, and the specifics in this bill carve out special treatment for body camera data, but anything that's not specified with regard to the treatment of that data in this bill would still be subject to all of the protections and enforcement components of the Data Practices Act. The Peace Officer Standards and Training Board is directed to adopt a model policy to be used by all law enforcement agencies employing body cameras. The Post Board is to consult with IPAD, which is the state government agency responsible for the oversight of Chapter 13 Data Practices Act. Post boards to consult with IPAD, law enforcement, prosecutors, the public, victim advocates, and defense attorneys in the development of the policies. Local law enforcement agencies are to establish and enforce a written policy that is substantially similar to the post board model policy. Law enforcement agencies are not authorized to use body cameras unless they comply with the policies created by the post board. With regard to the specific delete everything amendment, I'd like to just provide some references for the members here. The definition of portable recording system data is the same language that was in the original bill. Lines 9 and 10 of page 1 add language defining redact. This language is taken from the Washington State body camera bill. And it's required due to language on 2.14 that deals with providing copies of that video. Page 1, lines 11 and 12 adds language defining use of force to the original underlying bill, as I've already described. Lines 13 through 17 add language on the private classification of the data, clarifying that the data is subject to the other provisions of the Data Practices Act, and adding a reference to the personnel data section to ensure that all data associated with a closed personnel complaint becomes public. There has also been some confusion on this point. Under current statute, when a personnel investigation is complete, the data does become public. Subsequently, closed investigations of police officers allow the data to become public. And so this bill clarifies that as well. Lines 18 to 27 outline the information that each law enforcement must maintain as public, as I described earlier, cameras owned, record of use, etc., and that language was in the bill as originally introduced. Lines 28 to 31 set the allowed retention time frame from 90 days up to 1 year. This gives law enforcement agencies the flexibility to set their own retention schedules within that set time frame. So, for example, the city of Minneapolis has available to its to persons that are involved in an incident with Minneapolis law enforcement the ability to file a claim or a complaint with an office that allows for investigation of those complaints. And in Minneapolis, they have 270 days from the incident date to be able to file that complaint. So any mandate to destroy data at day 90 or day 180 might result in a situation where a complaint is filed, but the body camera data has been destroyed. And that would then not be available for the investigating agency to utilize in its investigation. So Minneapolis could set their retention period longer than 90 days if they wanted to do so, but other jurisdictions may have different time frames that are important to them. However, that minimum threshold of 90 days will give persons that are involved in a law enforcement incident the opportunity to reflect on whether or not they wish to do anything with that data. And they wouldn't have to make that decision immediately after the incident occurs. It allows the agencies to individually balance the expense of retaining the data over the liability of prematurely destroying the data. And that's an important balancing act in this bill, members. It is extraordinarily expensive to store the volume of data that will be generated by body cameras. I think I've got my numbers right, but right now in the city of Minneapolis, they have squad car cameras that create about 270,000 videos a year. The expectation is, even without the full force using body cameras, that it will create at least 1 million body camera videos a year. And all you have to do is look at your own pocket electronic devices to know there's a lot of memory that's involved in storing video and audio. So when you start adding this up, there's a lot of memory that's involved in retaining this data in a usable form. And that's expensive. And so individual jurisdictions will be able to balance for themselves the expense involved in maintaining the data versus the chance that if there's a claim that arises that that data will be relevant for after the data has been destroyed, that they're going to perhaps have less of an opportunity to defend themselves without that camera data. Now, there may be some agencies that see 90 days as too long a time to keep the data, but we selected 90 days and we thought that that would be appropriate. Members, lines 1.32 to 2.2 deal with the flagging of data for a longer retention period. And I've already described to you sort of the essence of that flagging idea, but the section was originally drafted to allow public access using the ACLU's suggested method of flagging certain videos. As drafted in the amendment, it requires the retention of video for at least 1 year and no longer than 3 years that involves a use of force related to a complaint filed against an officer or where an individual articulates specific facts to support a reasonable belief that misconduct by an officer occurred. It doesn't necessarily mean that video automatically becomes public. It would become public under the other framework that's already been described, but it would at least be retained for a longer period of time. I know there are some other organizations, including the MPPOA, that had some concerns about making data public that is related to complaints, as being the language being overbroad and for the potential for misuse. And so once again, the language before you is an attempt to balance these sometimes competing concerns that we have here. I anticipate that this language will allow for a starting point for the debate to classify the data as public at a future time. We may take a look back in another legislative session, for example, or later during this session to address these questions. And it's part of the reason I didn't want to make a final decision on this bill today. I wanted a chance for us to hear the public input. Lines 2.3 to 2.11 outline who may request that the data be retained. The subject of the data may request that the data be retained for 90 days instead of the language that was in the original bill of a reasonable time. Because 90 days, for one thing, is a lot easier to understand and to abide by than the language reasonable time. And also that reasonable time was in the original bill to be determined by law enforcement, and I thought it'd be better for everyone concerned to have a specific number there, so there wasn't any one party or the other making that kind of a decision about destruction of the data. But it also gives the flexibility for the chief law enforcement officer, who's the supervisor of a subject of the data, to request retention of the video from that officer's agency as well as from other law enforcement agencies. So it provides for some supervisory accountability within the agency as well. Lines 212 to 215 outline access to the data when there is a dispute among the data subjects as to its release. So you can imagine a situation where you have a domestic dispute and the police officers come in with the camera running, and you've got the video of the perpetrator, the video of the victim, maybe the video of some kids running around, maybe the video of the unfinished tax returns on the desk, all becoming government data because now it's on the body camera. And you also have the potential there for one party, one subject, assuming if the domestic dispute is not resolved amicably between the two domestic persons, where one party may wish to utilize the information in that video to harm the other person that's in that video, whether it becomes part of a child custody dispute, whether it becomes part of an exploitation effort, whether it becomes part of threats or extortion. So we needed to get some balancing of the interests in here, and this is my attempt to do that here, so that all the data subjects would be allowed to view the full unredacted video. The data subject, it also allows them to object to the release of the video, and if they do so, that there would have to be redaction before the video was released publicly. And I'm anticipating there still may be some concerns with redacting images of a victim, but still being identifiable. I mean, if you're in someone's home and you know there are two people there, from the public narrative, police reports, for example, it's not hard to figure out who's redacted and who isn't. So again, potentially some irreconcilable interests here that we're struggling to address. The audit provisions on line 2.16 to 2.19 requires a three-year audit. This language is taken from the license plate reader bill. It adopts the same time frame. The model policy language we've already described, and that is also similar to the license plate reader bill. And then the agency requirement to adopt that policy is similar to what was in the bill that was originally introduced. So I hope that sets a little bit of the context for this discussion. And I know there are some that would have preferred that the default position for the language for the data be public, and that we have selective provisions that allow it to be flagged as private data. I believe, given the sensitivity of some of the data that's going to be on these cameras, especially when you've got officers going into people's homes, that the best premise to start with was to make the data private and then define the circumstances under which it could become public. So with that stated, I look forward to the discussion among the members of the committee and very importantly, to the presentations by those who have an interest in testifying today. Madam Chair, I look forward to that testimony. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Latz. First on our list, we have Dennis Flaherty, Minnesota Police and Peace Officers Association. Mr. Flaherty, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Dennis Flaherty, and I'm Executive Director of the Minnesota Police and Peace Officers Association, which represents about 8,500 officers that are employed by all levels of government. And I'd like to begin by thanking Senator Latz for his willingness to take on this very important subject. And I want to say that acknowledge that we view body cameras as an effective law enforcement tool, and with indications that their use will bring about a new paradigm for police by making us more accountable and transparent to the public we serve. Further indications are that the use of the technology will lead to reduced exposure to litigation and unwarranted complaints from citizens. However, like all new technology, comes the need to have appropriate safeguards to protect the public and the officers, and that's why we first approached Senator Latz with this challenge.
I want to thank you, by the way.
As part of normal police interaction with the public, I think you clearly understand that many, many times, in fact, maybe most often, we see the public at bad times in their life or sometimes at embarrassing moments for them. We enter their homes when maybe they might be in conditions that they probably would not want the world to view, times when they would not want a camera rolling and then later released for the entire world to see. And of course, we are also concerned that if Senator Latz's proposal does not prevail to protect or provide provide non-public, that we could be creating a new classification of persons that just simply are not going to want to contact the police. They're not going to want them to come in their homes. They're not going to want to meet with cops if the camera is going to be rolling and then later made public for everyone to see. And so we believe very strongly that the bill correctly classifies the data private with some exceptions. And we see this as something that will protect citizens, and also that making the data public really serves no public purpose. I think that there are probably some under the assumption cops oppose the use of cameras. That is not true. We do not. We have officers, as we speak right now, wearing cameras as they go about the communities they work in. Duluth, Burnsville, a pilot project in Minneapolis, just to name some of the ones that I'm aware of. And but just as we want to make sure citizens are protected, we want to make sure that our members are protected as well and that they have access to the data. There seems to be some, at least maybe it's just on my part, but I think on others, about who is the subject of the data. And is the officer the subject of the data? In the original bill, it made reference to both officer and subjects of the data. And because we are concerned that officers do have access to the data, that officers can flag or request that the data be held longer than the normal retention schedule, and that they do have access to it before they prepare reports or would give a formal statement. Those are absolutely essential elements that we think need to be better clarified in the bill. It does allow the subjects of the data to request that data be held, request copies of the data, but not specifically does it give those same things to officers. And so I don't know what the intent necessarily was, but clearly those are important issues for us. And then lastly, of critical concern is allegations of misconduct involving a police officer. And as I hope you know, most of these allegations, when properly and fully investigated, are found to be unfounded, that they lack justification or cause. Oftentimes they're made at the heat of the moment, or somebody's angry at a cop and wants to get even, or whatever the issue may be that gives rise to the complaint. Whatever retention schedule that this body selects, let's assume we're talking the 90 days, we don't want on the 91st day someone to be able to walk into the department and when they know the very evidence that is crucial to protect the officer or to support the officer has been destroyed. And so I understand that Senator Latz is willing to address that. I believe he might have an amendment to it. But that's very important to us, and that will happen. We know that if it's 60 days on the 61st day, we will have people knowing that the data now that would not be favorable to them is destroyed, and that's when they would come in. So we are concerned about that. I pledge to work with Senator Latz and all of you on this so that we can bring about a law that first and foremost protects the public, but equally important certainly to us and I hope to you that is fair to the officers that are going to be using this technology, and I certainly would stand for questions.
Senator Latz, do you want to ask members about questions as your testifiers come up or at the end?
Yeah, I think while the testifier is at the table, that would be fine. All certainly, right. If they have a question they think of later, testifier
does
can come back.
So either anybody way, so have questions for Director Flaherty? Seeing none, thank you. Thank you, and I'll sign in. And then next we have Chief Eric Gasecki. Am I saying your name right?
Gasecki, that's close enough.
Madam Chair, before Chief Gasecki testifies, I'm going to say I've known Chief Gasecki for probably 25
How do you say
years.
It?
I pronounced it right, didn't I?
Correct.
Mm-hmm.
Gasecki.
Yeah.
Gasecki.
He was a young police officer in Burnsville, and I was an assistant attorney general prosecuting implied consents. And so we had a number of occasions that we came across each other at that time, and so it's a real pleasure to be back in this new setting with him.
Thank you.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Hall.
I'd like to second that. Officer Gasecki was from my town and my chief. I've had respect for him, a man of integrity, for many years. Matter of fact, if I call anybody up on these things, I usually call him to give me his side of a lot of the issues. And I would call him a friend of mine. So I'm real proud to have him here today.
Thank you.
Okay, Chief, the pressure's on.
I guess. Can I be done? Madam Chair, members of the committee, as you said, I'm Eric Gasecki, Burnsville's police chief. Thanks for giving me the opportunity to be here today. To give you some perspective, we're a community of 60,000, 75 sworn officers, 55 officers is what I would consider frontline officers who are out there Every day we typically handle anywhere from 45 to 50,000 calls for service a year, to give you some perspective. I also would like to thank Senator Latz for taking this on, for proposing this bill. I believe it gives us some good direction, and I think it'll point us in the right direction as well. I can just say from Burnsville's experience, we've had body cameras, or at least some body cameras, in use since 2010. It's been a valuable tool for us. And looking at this bill, I do support what's in here, that a portion or a majority of what we collect on the video should remain non-public. It's been a tool for us that's worked well on many occasions. Our community expects us to be transparent and accountable, and we're able to do that through the use of these type of camera systems. Our elected officials expect our police department to be professional and also transparent. And again, the body cameras has allowed us to do that. So I echo a lot of what Mr. Flaherty said as well. Law enforcement officers in Burnsville that I know of are supportive of cameras, see it as a valuable tool, and it's really just making sure we get the classification on some of this information that's available balanced so it meets the needs of both the police, the community, and the members in the community that we deal with or perhaps take enforcement action against. With that, I don't know if there's any specific questions for me, but I do want to say that I do think a lot of what's in this bill we support. In addition to the audits, the accountability piece I think is good. We're open to discussions on model policy. The one piece that I didn't see in here that we'd also be open to is mandatory training in addition to the policy, something that the post board looks at and approves and make sure we do that on a regular or annual basis. So I think we can even change some things in here to make the officers more accountable, better trained, and where we want to be as a professional agency.
Thank you, Chief. Are there any questions for the Chief? Senator Hall.
Madam Chair and Officer or Chief Gieske, I think it was you that mentioned to me something about the safeguards we have nowadays where maybe we didn't have 5-10 years ago, keeping officers accountable that may breach and kind of dig in some of the data. Can you explain that to me again?
Chair, Senator Hall, yes, thanks for asking that. There's different systems out there, so I can speak to what Burnsville has. I know there's different ways to store the data. We use a cloud-based storage, which has an audit trail, which keeps a record of who accesses the video, how they access it, date and time. That's all time-stamped. It also requires the officers acknowledge why they're accessing the video. So we have a way to look back and control that.
And Senator Officer Hall. Gieske, thank you, Madam Chair. What happens if somebody breaches that or were to can they mess with the camera itself? Can they change anything on the camera? If they were to do something, an officer do something wrong or didn't want somebody to see, is any of that pulled out besides if they left it on maybe using the restroom or something?
That's a good question. The way our cameras are set up, the officers can't manipulate, alter, delete, or manipulate or change the video at all. It's secure within the camera. After their shift, it's locked into a, we call a docking system. It's uploaded. It's the only people that can delete that would be people who have approval to do it. So there's actually a review process. So it's not something an officer could delete or manipulate in any way. So that's another safeguard that we have in place.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any more questions, members? Thank you, Chief.
Thank you.
Next on the agenda is Bob Kroll, Minneapolis Police Department, and Vice President of Police Officers Federation of Minneapolis.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Again, and for the record, it's Lieutenant Bob Kroll, Vice President of Police Officers Federation of Minneapolis. I represent the 800-plus officers of the rank and file of the Minneapolis Police Department. I'm going to echo much of which the Chief just did and Dennis Flaherty. We also have supported the use of body cameras from the start. We were part of developing the SOP that rolled them out for our test project that's currently occurring. We have 36 cameras in use that were put in place in the fall, and we see it as a valuable tool in policing. The main concern that we have is the data retention. The complaint process in Minneapolis for many years under our old civilian review authority would allow people to make complaints against the police for up to 1 year after the fact. Why you need 1 year to determine if you were mistreated by the police is beyond me, but the new OPCR rules, Office of Police Conduct Review, has reduced that to 270 days, which is a step in the right direction. The biggest thing that we would like is to preserve the evidence to either, you know, prove the allegation against the officers if they in fact did commit misconduct, or on the other hand, clear the officer for any allegations that are unfounded. So the key component that we want to see is the time that the data is retained linked to the allowable time for a complaint to be made against the officers. It's a great tool. They've been working to our benefit since they've been rolled out. We fully support it. Thanks, Senator, for bringing it forward. But it's a huge concern to the Minneapolis Police Department that we have the timelines for accepting a complaint in line. And we'd even like to interject a proposed amendment that the MPPOA drafted up. No department or agency shall commence a disciplinary proceeding or an issue a reprimand against a peace officer wherein recorded data relevant to the alleged behavior has been destroyed pursuant to this subdivision. With that, I'll entertain questions.
Any questions for Lieutenant Kroll, members? Seeing none, thank you very much for your testimony, Lieutenant. Next
Madam Chair?
Yes.
With regard to that proposed amendment, I've been kind of noodling over this and some variations of that as well. And I think what I intend to do right now is to not offer any specific amendment to the bill that's before us today. Like that and other proposals that are talked about today, I want to have time to consider all the input we receive. And when we come back at a subsequent hearing, then I'll offer the amendments that I think the bill ought to be in shape at that point, and the committee can decide how to handle it. But thank you for the input.
Next on the agenda is Ben Feist. I hope I said that right, but you can correct me, with the American Civil Liberties Union.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and that's correct, Feist. Now that I'm a constituent, I expect you to have that right.
Thank you for being here.
So I'm the legislative director with the American Civil Liberties Union of Minnesota. As many of you know, we are often up here on a variety of issues that have to do with police practices and privacy. And I first want to start by thanking Senator Latz for his thoughtful analysis that has gone into the process so far, and also his flexibility moving forward. As anyone who has really dug into this issue of body cameras and how to regulate them would know, you get lost in all of the different issues that come up. We have the data retention, we have classification, and then we have the appropriate uses for this. So we don't think that there is irreconcilable issues here, however. I did provide to Senator Latz a three-page list of suggestions, which has now been out here as a handout for the committee and those interested in the ACLU's position. Our attempt to do this really comes from two issues that the ACLU feels very strongly about. On the one hand, we really believe in the accountability and transparency potential for body camera technology. We believe that this could have a huge impact on getting public trust back in law enforcement, and see this as a good for everyone. That said, we're often up here with issues about government surveillance of the people and the privacy implications involved. So it's taken a long time for even our organization to get our head around this and figure out where we come down. As it stands in the current bill, we do believe that this goes a little bit backwards in its approach. We believe that rather than starting at the classification issue and starting with the point that it should all be private and then moving forward to the other issues such as what will be appropriate use, we would turn that around and say that where you really need to start to make sure that you have accountability, which is the real value here, is all of the issues that will, under this bill, be sorted out through a statewide model policy. And we don't have in front of us today what would go into that policy specifically. But I think that's where I'll start. And since this has been outlined in our handout, I won't go through it all in gory detail because I know we have others to hear from today. But I just want to make a couple quick points on it. I think we need to start looking at this technology from the perspective that officers shouldn't have the discretion to edit the content that's coming in. And we need to know, as the public, that the cameras will be on and off at certain times. What we're suggesting is simply that law enforcement be required to turn the camera on at the inception of every encounter with a member of the public and then turn it off at the conclusion of the encounter as a starting point. So what we're imagining is that that would include stops, frisks, searches, arrests, consensual interviews, enforcement actions, and any encounter that becomes in any way hostile or confrontational. This is probably the most important issue for the ACLU of Minnesota. Without knowing that we are going to capture all of these things, we believe that use of body cams would be essentially used against the public as another form of surveillance to try to simply catch the bad guy, and that we would lose the big accountability issue here. We also recognize that there are times that we don't want to be recording, even under those circumstances, and that there are legitimate privacy concerns. One thing we want to point out is that we don't want to see generalized activity filmed. First Amendment activities, such as a protest, for example, shouldn't just be filmed throughout the duration, but rather just if there's a specific encounter with a citizen. Then the bill should, and I think we're starting to get there a little bit, try to figure out the privacy protections for three specific areas. Use of body cameras in private residences, use of a body camera with persons seeking to anonymously report a crime or provide information on an investigation, and persons identified as victims of crimes. As far as I know, I think law enforcement would largely agree with that, and we are certainly willing to meet their needs as well and trying to make sure that this is used with the right public safety background. The next issue is notification of recording, and under this bill, it sounds like that, again, could be worked out at the model policy level, but we believe it's essential to get something done here at the legislature that would say that we will know when a recording is happening. I understand from previous testimony under the Minneapolis SOP that they did not have a policy in place to notify anyone that recording is going on one way or the other, and even if there was the question of whether the interaction was being recorded, they didn't necessarily have to be truthful in responding whether or not the camera was on. We take issue with that approach and believe that the only way to successfully have the accountability feature of body cameras work for the public is to make absolutely clear that this is being on, that the camera is on, and that the citizen will understand that their actions are being recorded, and they will also know that if there is a problem, they can make a complaint or otherwise file a request for that. There are various ways to do it, but I think the most important thing here is that we just are absolutely clear that there is notification. And the notification piece also plays into the idea that there are times where we would want citizens to be able to request that the recording stop. Again, in situations where you're in a private residence or you'd like to anonymously report a crime, or if you're a victim of a crime, you would need to know first that the recording is happening and then have the opportunity to request that it stop. Senator Latz has made some updates for a flagging process under the amended bill, and we appreciate that. There are a number of times that we believe these things should be flagged because they have more value to the public and to individuals than other circumstances. And the way I would describe this is that, again, under the way our way of seeing things, if a police officer were to start a recording when I walk up on the street and ask where the nearest coffee shop is at, and that's where that situation ends, that has a different type of value than it does in one of the situations where there's a use of force, it leads to an arrest, or something of this nature. So we really want to differentiate there, and that makes a difference going forward in terms of how we see retention and data classification working. As to the retention issues here, we do believe that unflagged videos have limited public value, and so we would actually be okay retaining those type of videos shorter than anything that is flagged. And we believe that this really is a privacy protection, ultimately, making sure that people understand that there won't be some giant government database of every interaction that you have out there, but rather only those that rise to the flagged level will have that. As alluded to before, we do come into the camp where we believe that body camera video should be presumed public to begin with. However, as I've alluded to, we also believe that there should be specific carve-outs to make things private, specifically in those areas that I've talked about before. And, you know, especially in terms of the flagged videos, we believe that those can be presumed to contain information of societal or news value and really do need to be considered public. At the end of the day, the accountability piece of body cameras will be significantly undermined if almost everything is private and there's only limited ways to make things public. So our provisional interest in supporting body cameras may go away entirely if the end product doesn't focus a little bit more on the accountability and a little bit less on the privacy side of things. We also believe that it would help to have a disciplinary procedure in place for officers who are found to be violating the policies in various ways, and also providing additional information in an audit than what is currently in the bill. But that's just sort of an overview of where we're at today. We are very much interested in continuing the conversation and hope that there's interest in finding a middle ground on this very complicated issue.
Thank you, Mr. Feist. Senator Limmer.
Mr. Feist, the question I had was, in your review of the bill, did you have any concern or was there any concern research regarding any Miranda issues? If a police officer comes up and starts speaking with someone, whether it's on a camera or whether it's not, is there a Miranda issue or is it just considered the same as a conversation with a police officer without a camera?
Mr. Feist.
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, that's not an issue that we've taken a look at. I'm not aware of there being anything there.
Madam Chair.
Senator Latz.
The requirements of Miranda versus Arizona only apply once a person is in custody. And then only then if an interrogation takes place, meaning questions are asked that are designed to elicit incriminating information. So only then does Miranda apply. And the remedy, if there's a violation, is the exclusion or suppression of the evidence that was gathered in violation of Miranda. But an ordinary encounter pre-arrest would not implicate Miranda at all.
Okay. Any other questions for Mr. Feist? Senator Hall?
No, for Mr. Feist.
Anyone else? Thank you, Mr. Feist.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, I have a question for our author here.
Sure. Senator Hall.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Latz, could you tell me if a mom or dad or child are in a park, maybe the mom or the dad falls over with a heart attack and dies, or the child just collapses and dies. Police officers come up. They have their cameras on. How is that categorized, that camera? Can a citizen in a situation like that, they're not a victim, in a sense, of a crime, can they know that their privacy, that their son or daughter that's laying there dead won't be seen by anybody that just wants to say, I'd like to see that picture, and then all of a sudden they take that information and throw it up on a web? Any thoughts on that?
Senator Latz.
Madam Chair, Senator Hall, I think that, well, the default classification would be private, and then there would have to be something that would make it public, either the subject or the data asking to have it, and with permission from the others that are in the video, you know, allowing it to be, you know, either unredacted or redacted. If an investigation took place, if there was some kind of criminal conduct that was suggested, be flagged as investigative data, and it remains private until the investigation is concluded, unless some of the other exceptions are found. But I think just an average citizen, curious onlooker, under this bill, I think would not be able to request a copy of the video.
Okay.
And that kind of brings up a larger question, too, you know, whether it's that kind of an incident or whether it's something, that might even be more troubling for subjects to be filmed about. I think I probably only need to say mugshot.com to tell you what the possible exploitative consequences could be of having everything be default public. I'll say no more on that one. Because I think
Senator Newman?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Latz, Senator Hall has now broached the subject that I've been kind of thinking about when I saw your bill coming up. I went home and talked to a couple of chiefs in my area, and this topic that Senator Hall just brought up was of major concern to both the chief and my husband. And what I was told is that, frankly, the majority of the police responses don't involve criminal activity. Most of them involve going to someone's home because they have fallen, or there's a medical emergency, or maybe there's a car accident, anything not involving criminal activity. And so I would simply ask you to, as your bill progresses, think about the privacy of the folks in their home, or the privacy of a family whose family member has been fatally injured in a car accident. Or, you know, those kinds of issues, I can't imagine the general public is going to want to lose control of that kind of body cam information. And I simply can't imagine that we would want the general public to be able to have access to that. While I do recognize that in a lot of instances, this body cam good idea, and I will again tell you that local law enforcement out where I live have intentionally not begin to use the body cams because they don't know where the legal issues are headed. So I would just ask you to consider those kinds of questions as you move forward.
Thank you.
Thank you. Now we will hear from Mark Anfinson from the Minnesota Newspaper Association.
Good. How are you?
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Anfinson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, Mark Anfinson, attorney for the Minnesota Newspaper Association. This is a good bill. It's not only a good bill, but it involves, as other witnesses have acknowledged, an incredibly complex spectrum of issues. However, we think it could be an even better bill with one simple revision, and that is to change the presumption at the core of the bill from private to public. And that's a significant change. And I've listened carefully to some of the comments of the committee members about these very private and sensitive contexts in which police are regularly called into. And nobody's here to argue that those things should be casually available to the news media or other people. But overall, there's been historically an extremely compelling reason in Minnesota to develop the Data Practices Act, as it's evolved for more than 30 years, where the presumption of public access especially applies to law enforcement records. And why is that? The answer is, I think, self-evident. There is no government agency or function of any kind that has more power over regular citizens and law enforcement agencies. And so the need to keep the maximum level of transparency and accountability with respect to their activities is absolutely fundamental in the law enforcement context. And this is a very significant departure from that tradition of the Minnesota legislature in dealing with law enforcement data. Now, we're not saying there shouldn't be exceptions to the access. There are already a multitude, a plethora of exceptions for law enforcement data access, many if not all of which would apply to this video and could be used by law enforcement. Senator Hall's example of the terrible incident in the park would almost certainly be covered by an existing exemption, as would many others that you would raise, which is in the law currently, which allows law enforcement to withhold photographs that are clearly offensive to common sensibilities. That would cover a very wide range of data. There are many, many others. Most of the criminal incidents that police would respond to would be covered by the active investigative data exception. That would be active investigative data. It might be weeks or even months before that video could even conceivably be public at all. And by that time, most people have forgotten about it. There's another very important issue that comes into play when you're talking about the Data Practices Act and its practical function with law enforcement. And that is, law enforcement agencies, as with most agencies, have a huge advantage where they have these 25 or so exceptions they can cite. Because if I ask for a particular record, particular item of data, they say, well, we think that photograph, that video is offensive to clearly offensive to common sensibilities. Now, what do I do? Do I get in a fist fight? Do I challenge them to a duel? I've thought about those things occasionally. But what you do as a citizen or a news reporter, a journalist, is you hit a brick wall. The agency keeps the video, and you've either got to go to court or do some other fairly difficult process to get past their reasonable, legitimate, good faith conclusion that that's not public data. And that would be used here all the time. And it would give, and again, it gives them an enormous and unstated advantage. If there are additional exceptions to public access, they can certainly be added. I'm a little skeptical that we need many more, but I'm open-minded about the possibility. I did listen with much interest to the testimony of the chief from Burnsville, Giesecke, who I believe said they've been using the body cams there since 2010. Has anyone heard of a problem? Is there any evidence that there's been some significant invasive disclosure of private or sensitive data because of that? Burnsville has been using the body cameras. Duluth has for several months. Minneapolis has a pilot program. Under current law, they're all public. I don't see that there's been any problem at all with that. And I don't think, if the exceptions are crafted and harmonized with this new technology, I think you can retain that vital presumption of public access. So the bottom line is there's going to be a real hammer placed on police accountability. A wonderful opportunity for enhanced accountability is going to be hammered pretty well by this non-public approach. There's also a pretty severe consequence, and I'm not here to lecture the cops about what's good for them, but this will interfere with their credibility. I don't think it's fully appreciated how much the current language of the bill will tie their hands from releasing video that exonerates them. If you've got 25 people on a video, or 10, and you've got to get all their consents before it can be publicly released, how easy is that going to be? You may not even know who some of those people are. You may not be able to find them. And then the answer is, well, you can redact. Redacting video is an extremely difficult task. And the bill doesn't just say you have to blur the identity, the face of the subject. You have to blur any data that could be used to identify them. So in many contexts, you're going to be trying to blur more than just the person's face. Digital blurring is a time-consuming, difficult technological task. And it's going to intrude, I'm telling you, on the ability of law enforcement to release these videos to exonerate themselves and to show that they have done nothing wrong. And that's going to be exacerbated enormously by the fact that once this video exists, now that you have it, the accusation is that cop did something terrible. And if the law enforcement agency says, no, we didn't, the video shows we didn't, okay, let me look at it. We can't release it because there's private data about a bunch of different people on it. How does that make the agency end up looking? Well, again, I appreciate the complexity. I appreciate the interest of privacy here. They're fully respected. I'm not talking against more exceptions to public access. But to completely abandon this traditional, historically important notion of a presumption of public access to law enforcement data, with respect to the hard work, enormous hard work the author has put in on this and will continue to do so for several weeks, we respectfully disagree with that approach. Thank you, members.
Thank you, Mr. Amphinson. Are there any questions for Mr. Amphinson? Seeing none, thank you for your testimony.
Thanks.
We have two more testifiers to go in about 7 minutes, including questions from members. So next on the list is Don Gemberling from the Minnesota Coalition of Government Information. Mr. Gemberling, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I'm always impressed with somebody who is willing to take on these issues. And that now includes Senator Latz. So,
it took all these years?
I've always been impressed. So, the current section of the Data Practices Act that deals with law enforcement data was enacted in 1981. It was based on a long discussion between law enforcement and the media, an inability of the law enforcement community and the media to come to agreement, and a legislatively imposed compromise. Okay? That compromise had three pieces. Allow law enforcement to do its job, protect certain privacy interests, but ultimately give the public the ability to get access to information to make sure that law enforcement was doing the job we wanted it to do. Okay? So the bill presents the following issue. If that's still a good idea, which I happen to think it is, that the way those three interests are balanced, does the mere change in a type of the methodology the government uses to collect information, should that change that balance? Because it is a very interesting kind of balance, okay? It's part of the ongoing discussion not only here and across the country. Unfortunately, the bill as drafted currently changes that balance. And the last two speakers have pointed out to you quite well why the balance has changed. Okay. Now, I understand there's a difference here in the technology. So in what we presented to Senator Latz from Minkoji was a series of amendments that we thought would cover the things that we had heard complained about, particularly private kinds of things, like homes. And those amendments aren't before you, okay? So that's kind of where we're from. If you want to continue the Minnesota tradition of accountability, of people who work for the government, and you have a balance that's been in force for over 30 years, I don't quite see how it's broke. Nobody's pointed that out to me. I've heard some things that just don't make any sense to me. Pictures of naked children will be on the net. Well, they won't be on the net if law enforcement does what it's supposed to do, which is not release data that, quote, is offensive to common sensibilities. Okay? The issue raised by Mr. Flaherty, I think, is an interesting issue which you need to spend some time on. If I walk into somebody's house with a camera on and I never identify myself so that the camera picks up the identification, and the only people I film are the people in the house, who's the subject of the data? I'm not. I don't appear on the data in any way, shape, or form. Okay? And that is one of the kind of perplexing issues about this kind of stuff. Now, in the interest of time, I want to take you to a very different direction. And that direction is as follows. As we all know, the Minnesota Government Data Practices Act regulates data maintained by government entities. That includes state, cities, counties, etc. The data in question here, as I understand the technology and based on testimony from the chief, these data are nowhere located in the state of Minnesota except on the cameras. The data are actually uploaded to Taser International, whose corporate headquarters are in Scottsdale, Arizona. Okay? So if, under the provisions of the bill, I'm a data subject and I want access to the data, how do I get access to the data? Well, I understand from Mr. Neumeister, who spends a lot more time than I do going to police departments, you have to send an email to Taser. Okay? But I'm really concerned about the fact that this data sits in a private company. Okay? Now, I talked to the chief from Bloomington when he was testifying before the other body, and I said, does your contract with Taser include the language required in the Data Practices Act that makes Taser subject to the Data Practices Act? He didn't know the answer to that question. He said he'd have to look, and I can understand that. He's got a lot to do. But unless you somehow deal with this phenomenon, then, you know, in theory, Taser, unless they're somehow tightly controlled legally, could put all of this on the net. And you have to go after them somehow. And as Mr. Amstenson has observed, it's hard enough suing the government about data practices issues, but I don't know about suing some company located in Scottsdale, Arizona. And in the reality of the modern world of information, for all I know, Taser could be transferring that data to Singapore, because that's a cheap place to store it. Okay? I'm not picking on Taser. It's just the way they do business and the way the electronics, for lack of a better word, work. But that's something I think you need to think very carefully about, because this is not the first time you're going to see this phenomenon. As you may have noticed in an article last week, Taser is not making money selling cameras. It's making money storing the data. If I remember right, the chief can correct me, I think it was $56 a month per camera, and they've got 56 cameras. I'm getting old, but my memory works sometimes. So multiply that times Minneapolis, which in theory will have, 400-500 cameras? That's an issue I think you really have to consider. So thank you. Thank you, Senator Latz. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer.
Senator Dziek.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If they have a contract, and I should know this, but if they have a contract
aren't they covered under the Timber Jay bill?
Senator Latz said something that I didn't hear the first part of the question.
If they have a contract with the city, they should have that language in there saying that they are covered under data practices, but if they don't, would they be covered under the Timber Jay bill of where it's not a loophole? Or is it the issue of they're not in Minnesota? Is that another issue?
Mr. Gamberling?
Madam Chairman, Senator Dedzic, under the Timber Jay bill, they should be covered, okay? But then you're to the next practical issue, okay? What if, for example, Taser says, well, to get at this stuff, we'd have to reveal trade secrets, and under the Data Practices Act, trade secrets aren't public, okay? Frankly, what I suggested to Senator Latz was you put language in the bill that essentially subjects these companies to presumptive damages if they do anything wrong. That would get their attention, I think. And maybe they do things right. So,
Senator Newman.
Mr. Gamberling, you and Mr. Anfinson sort of touched on one of the issues that kind of worries me. Specifically, you said that if the police do their job, this information isn't going to wind up on the net. And I'm not so sure I agree with you. Mm-hmm. And I say that because hackers are becoming increasingly sophisticated and successful. And I say that because there are folks who work within law enforcement who have misbehaved badly when it comes to private information. And so, you know, I'm not willing to just accept your thought that, you know, if the cops do what they're supposed to do, this isn't going to wind up on the net. Because truly I believe that our local law enforcement have our best interest at heart. But there are some people out there in this world that misbehave, and I'm not at all convinced that this, in some very private instances, this information that's gathered by body cams is not going to wind up on the net because people are misbehaving with it. And with all of our good intentions, I really think that's going to happen. And it's going to really hurt some people in the private sector that have no intention whatsoever of letting that kind of information.
Thank you.
Madam Chair,
Gamberling.
Senator Newman, I can't agree with you more. So, you know, at some point, hopefully one of you will carry a bill that will do more to make private companies liable for the fact they're not willing to invest money in the kind of security that they need to have in this day and age, okay? The fact that Target offered me a year of looking at my credit reports, that was fine, but why did the problem happen in the first place? And from what I read, they didn't make the investment in security they should have made. Now, maybe those hackers in Russia, which is where they seem to be, a lot of them, are so good we can't defeat them, but we at least ought to try. So,
hack the hackers.
Pardon me?
Hack the hackers.
Yeah. Well, there's within the hacker community, strangely, Senator Newman, what they end up doing, large numbers of them, is they go to work for the private sector as consultants on how to beat hacking. So,
thank you. Next up is Lieutenant Colonel Shelley Schroffer from the State Patrol. Welcome to the committee, Lieutenant Colonel.
Madam Chair, members, thank you. Shelley Schroffer, Lieutenant Colonel for the State Patrol. And in the interest of time, I'll keep my comments extremely brief. Currently, the State Patrol does not implement any body cameras. And as I sit here and listen today, I hear this bill referred to commonly as body camera bill. The State Patrol's concern very briefly has to do with definition, defining what a portable recording system data device is and what that means. For purposes of the State Patrol, our in-squad video cameras have a portable recording, audio recording device worn by the officers as they approach vehicles. We typically don't go into homes and businesses. Typically, most of our business is out on the roadside. So the concern that we have, simply put, is that if the bill were to move forward in its current format, There are implications for the State Patrol and our current recording systems that we do use in the squads. In its current format as well, there would be implications, fiscal implications for us if we were to be required to adhere to the bill's requirements of blurring or distorting audio. We don't have the capability that currently exists with our current technology. So I promise to keep that brief. I hope that met the...
That was very, very good. Anybody on the committee have a question for Lieutenant Colonel? Seeing none, thank you very much for your testimony. And that wraps up those who were scheduled to testify. So, Senator Latz, do you want, I know you want to lay this bill over for further consideration, and would you like to have some ending statements?
Madam Chair, I'd certainly be open. I know we had the list of those who had notified us ahead of time, but I'd be comfortable. I know it's running long, but if there was anyone else in the audience that felt compelled to add to the conversation something that has not been already said, I'd be interested in hearing that as well while we have the public hearing going on.
Okay, is there anybody else in the audience that would wish to testify? Seeing none.
Madam Chair, could I ask a question?
I think so.
Madam Chair, Senator Latz, I don't envy you on this bill. This is a bill that goes in a million different directions and a lot of different, not only competing directions, but I just remember recently, and this is just a word of observation, and that is in the last few months we saw the events of Ferguson, we saw the events out in New York with various police action, oftentimes justified, other times in question by the community. And yet at the same time, it seems like whenever there was not a recording of some sort revealed to the public, tensions would go up. And when there was, if there was a film of some sort on a particular incident, and let's say it justified the police action, then the tensions, although they still existed, they went down considerably because the public could see what was going on. And I know we don't mandate body cams right now, but the one thing that I remind myself on it is it seems like when we do have camera and it is available to the public, it oftentimes exonerates the police department. I think that's proven itself on dash cams, whereas before, and I hate to keep admitting it, but I was here before dash cams were around, and I think in most cases, I don't think cameras are something we should be fearful of, but at the same time, there's a lot to be said about the public having an ability to look at it quickly and either in their own mind, consider whether or not we have a problem from the administration of justice or if we don't. And so as we struggle through this issue, I think that's something we should keep in the back of our minds, because I know that in certain states that didn't reveal cameras or didn't have it, the tensions were high, and it even went to the point of destruction of property. I think some people's lives were lost as a result of it, and I think that's important to keep in mind as well.
All right. Senator Latz.
This has been a very informative hearing, Madam Chair, and I appreciate the interest of all the stakeholders that have participated. Still welcome any input that may have been raised by the conversation we've had here today, and look forward to trying to figure out our way to a comprehensive bill. So with that said, I'll ask that the chair would lay the bill over.
Okay. Then we have Senate File 498 as amended to be laid over until a future time. No set time. I want to make an announcement about the next meetings. Next Tuesday, February 24th at noon, The Judiciary Finance Committee will convene to hear a small appropriations bill for the Private Detectives Board. Immediately following, the Judiciary Policy Committee will gavel in to hear a series of bills related to data practices. Commissioner confirmations may be added. Thank you all for coming and the respectful way in which this committee was held. Thank you.
We're always respectful.
Oh, we are adjourned.
Thanks, Chief.